I want you to imagine, just for a moment, that you are sitting in a sterile, brightly lit clinic room.
Okay, setting the scene.
Right. And you are holding this small white pill in the palm of your hand.
Yeah.
You're suffering from chronic debilitating pain, like the kind of pain that just colors every waking moment of your life.
Right, real agony.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And before you swallow this pill, a physician in a white coat sits down across from you, looks you dead in the eye, and tells you explicitly that the pill in your hand has absolutely zero active ingredients.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. They tell you it's a sugar pill. There's no hidden medication inside. There's no trick at all.
So you know it's fake.
You know it's fake, but you swallow it anyway. You drink a little water, and within 20 minutes, that chronic pain genuinely physically vanishes.
That's incredible to even think about.
Right. The tension in your muscles releases, your heart rate drops, and the agony just melts away. So the question is, how is that physically possible?
Well, the immediate instinct for most people is to assume it's just a trick of the mind, you
It's
know?
like you're faking it.
Kind of, yeah. You want it to work so badly that you just convince yourself the pain is gone? Or, you know, perhaps you're just trying to be a good patient.
Oh, to please the doctor.
Exactly. You report feeling better just to make the doctor happy. I mean, we've been conditioned to think of this phenomenon as a kind of psychological illusion.
A trick. But the reality is infinitely more profound. Welcome to today's deep dive. We are looking at a stack of research today that completely upends everything you think you know about the placebo effect.
It really does. It shatters the conventional understanding entirely.
Because for the better part of a century, modern medicine has treated the placebo effect as like an annoying confound.
Yeah, a glitch in the data.
Right. A nuisance that ruins rigorous clinical trials. Something researchers have to mathematically subtract just to find out if a real drug actually works. But our source material today is this mind-bending 2026 paper by C.F. Dietz.
Yes, titled The Grammar of Healing: Placebo, Nocebo, and Downward Causation Between Closure Levels.
It's quite a title. But Dietz is arguing that we have had this backwards for decades. The placebo effect isn't a glitch in the data. It is the empirical proof of a biological superpower.
It fundamentally reorients how we understand the relationship between, well, conscious thought and cellular biology.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to prove this isn't just positive thinking, we have to look at what happens when the brain's hardware for expectation is literally damaged. Right.
Exactly. We can't just talk about mysterious mind-body auras. We have to look at the hard wiring of the brain.
And that takes us to Fabrizio Benedetti's work.
Right. Benedetti, in the mid-2000s, he recognized a critical flaw in how we usually think about placebos.
Which is what?
Well, if the placebo effect is just some generalized mystical aura of healing or, you know, just a byproduct of having a good attitude, then it shouldn't really matter what specific state your brain anatomy is in.
But it does
It
matter.
matters entirely. And he demonstrated this by studying patients with Alzheimer's disease.
Alzheimer's is a disease of progressive physical degradation in the brain. It physically destroys neural pathways.
Yeah, so Benedetti is looking at a population where the hardware is slowly being dismantled. He published this landmark study in 2006 looking at placebo analgesia.
Which is the clinical term for pain relief triggered by a placebo, right?
Yeah. Correct. So he looked at patients across a spectrum of cognitive impairment. He had a control group of healthy adults, a group with mild to moderate Alzheimer's, and then a group with severe cognitive impairment.
Okay. And he tested them all for this placebo pain relief.
Yes. He put them all in a clinical context designed to induce a strong placebo effect.
I would assume that as the disease progresses, your ability to understand that clinical context, like the white coat, the needle, the instructions, that starts to fade.
It does. In the patients with mild to moderate impairment, the placebo response was still present, but it was noticeably reduced.
Because they're losing the cognitive resolution required to process the whole ritual.
Exactly. But the critical paradigm-shifting finding happened in the severely impaired group. These were patients who had sustained significant physical degradation to their prefrontal cortex.
And what happened with them?
In those patients, the placebo response wasn't just diminished, it was entirely non-existent. A flat zero.
Wow. Wait, let's pause and define what the prefrontal cortex is actually doing here. For anyone listening who hasn't, looked at a brain map recently,
Sure.
the prefrontal cortex is the area right behind your forehead. And it is essentially the brain's simulator, right?
That's a great way to put it. Yeah.
It's the hardware that allows you to project a version of yourself into the future. It's the part of you that says, I'm sitting in a clinic, a doctor just gave me a treatment. Therefore, my body is going to feel better in 10 minutes.
It's the time-traveling part of the brain. It generates representations of future states. And Alzheimer's, particularly in its severe stages, robs a person of that specific future-oriented projection.
So if you physically destroy the hardware that imagines the future self, the patient can no longer hold the expectation of impending relief.
Right. And without that expectation, the placebo effect vanishes.
But, I mean, the immediate skeptical response here is, wait, did their pain system just break entirely?
Like maybe they just couldn't feel pain relief at all.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe they didn't get placebo pain relief because their brain just forgot how to turn off pain altogether.
Benedetti actually anticipated that exact objection, and this is the genius of the study design.
What did he do?
He gave these exact same severely impaired patients actual pharmacological painkillers, an active drug.
Yeah.
And their bodies responded perfectly.
Oh, wow.
The active drug worked exactly as it was supposed to. Their underlying biology was fully functional. The drug worked, but the placebo did not.
That's fascinating. In neuroscience, when you find a split like that, it's called a dissociation, isn't it?
Yes, a clear dissociation.
And what this proves is that we're dealing with two completely different starting points for the same finish line.
Exactly. If you give someone an active pharmacological painkiller, you are initiating a biological cascade from the bottom up.
Right. A physical molecule enters the bloodstream, travels to the spinal cord, and acts like a key in a lock.
It binds to a receptor and sends a signal up to the brain saying, turn down the pain. It starts in the body and moves up.
And the placebo effect initiates that exact same cascade, but it starts from the top down.
Yes. It originates in the prefrontal cortex. It isn't just a passive observer of the body's state. It's a command center.
So when it generates that expectation of relief, it sends a signal down.
Down into the descending pain modulatory system, which is a massive network of nerves traveling from the brain down the spinal cord.
But if the prefrontal cortex is destroyed by Alzheimer's, that top-down cascade cannot begin.
It does not matter how elaborate the clinical ritual is or how comforting the doctor's words are. The initiating hardware is just gone.
So it's a bit like a computer hooked up to a perfectly functioning printer.
Oh, I like this analogy.
Let's say the printer represents the body's internal pain relief system, the biological machinery that actually stops the pain. Now, if you want to test the printer, you can walk right up to it, bypass the computer entirely, and press the manual test print button on the side of the machine.
Right, and it prints a page.
Exactly. That manual button press is the active drug. It operates the machinery directly from the bottom up.
The drug doesn't need the computer's permission to make the printer work.
Right. But if you want to initiate the process via conscious intention, if you want to print a custom document, you have to type it out on the computer and hit print on the keyboard.
And in this analogy, the computer's operating system is the prefrontal cortex.
Exactly. If that operating system is broken, or if the motherboard is physically fried by Alzheimer's, you can smash that print key on the keyboard all day long.
Nothing is going to happen.
Nothing. The printer itself is perfectly fine. The ink is full, the paper is loaded, but you can't hit print from the keyboard.
It's a great analogy. It highlights the necessity of that causal link, but there is a risk there, an objection that Dietz points out in his text.
Does it mean the cognitive part is just a luxury add-on?
That's exactly the reductionist trap. A hardcore skeptic looks at the Alzheimer's study and says, well, if the bottom-up drug works, even when the brain is damaged, that proves the drug is the only thing that really matters.
Because if the manual button on the printer works, who needs the computer?
Right. They view the top-down cognitive part as fluff. But Dietz argues that this completely inverts the logic of evolutionary biology.
How so?
The human brain did not evolve this incredibly complex, metabolically expensive, descending pain modulatory system just to be a luxury add-on. It's a distinctly active, massive component of our total therapeutic response.
So when you are a healthy person, a huge percentage of the healing you experience from any medical intervention is actually this top-down system firing.
Firing alongside the bottom-up chemistry, yes. It's not redundant, it's essential.
Okay, so if we accept that the prefrontal cortex hitting print is step one, we need to see the actual ink hitting the page.
Right, the actual biology.
What is the precise biological cascade happening inside your body? Because we have to prove this isn't just imagination.
To find that proof, we have to look at the staggering neuroimaging and pharmacological evidence. And the foundational study here is from Levine, Gordon, and Fields in 1978.
So this isn't exactly brand new?
No, it goes back decades. They were studying patients recovering from dental surgery, specifically getting impacted wisdom teeth removed.
Oh, man. Yeah. Having had my wisdom teeth out, I can confirm that is a situation of undeniable physical agony.
It's the perfect environment to study pain. So they set up intravenous lines in these post-operative patients. They gave some patients standard doses of morphine. But for others, they secretly administered an injection of saline pure salt water through the fiber.
And because it's a clinical setting, I assume they had a placebo effect.
Yes. Many of the patients who received the hidden salt water reported significant, measurable pain relief.
But that alone doesn't prove how the pain dropped.
Right. And that's where the genius of the study comes in. They took those specific patients, the ones currently feeling relief from salt water, and gave them a second drug called naloxone.
Naloxone. For anyone who has followed the opioid crisis, you likely know that by its brand name, Narcan.
Yes, the drug used by paramedics to instantly reverse an opioid overdose.
And it works purely mechanically. It's an opioid antagonist. If you picture an opioid receptor as a keyhole, and morphine as the key that turns the lock to stop pain.
Naloxone is a master key that fits the exact same keyhole, but it doesn't turn the lock.
It just jams it up, right? It physically blocks any opioids from getting in.
That is exactly how it functions. So they inject this opioid blocker into the patients who are feeling relief from the saltwater placebo.
Now what happens?
Almost immediately, their pain returned in full force.
Wow. The naloxone blocked the placebo effect.
Yes. And the shockwave of that finding is massive, because the only way naloxone can block pain relief is if that pain relief is actively being caused by opioids binding to receptors.
They weren't given any opioids. They were given salt water.
Exactly. This proved that the patient's brains were manufacturing and releasing their own endogenous opioids, endorphins, in response to the expectation of relief.
The brain literally opened its own internal pharmacy.
Yes. The placebo effect wasn't in their imagination. It was real physical pharmacology happening inside their own biology.
It's one thing to deduce that from a drug interaction in 1978. It's another thing entirely to see it happen in real time, which we can do now, right?
We absolutely can. The imaging technology caught up. In 2005, John Carzughetta put healthy volunteers in a PET scanner and induced a placebo effect.
And a PET scan lets you watch the chemistry of the brain light up on a screen.
Yes, on a molecular level.
Yeah.
And Zubieta watched in real time as opioid receptors in specific regions of the brain, the nucleus accumbens, the anterior cingulate, and the prefrontal cortex literally lit up with activity.
Just to translate that, the nucleus accumbens is the reward center, right? And the anterior cingulate processes the unpleasantness of pain.
Exactly. And these are the exact same anatomical regions that would light up if you injected the patient with actual medical grade morphine. The molecular machinery is identical.
And didn't he find that it matched their expectations?
Yes. The magnitude of the endogenous opioid release perfectly correlated with how much pain relief the patient said they were expecting.
So the stronger the conscious expectation, the larger the physical dose of opioids, the prefrontal cortex administered.
That's right.
But wait, does the brain only know how to manufacture opioids? Or can it release other things?
It is so much more specific than just opioids. Fabrizio Benedetti did another study in 1999 looking at the condition-specific nature of this response.
What does that mean?
He conditioned patients by giving them a non-opioid painkiller for a few days. A drug that reduces pain using a completely different chemical mechanism, not the opioid receptors.
So he's teaching the body to expect a very specific kind of chemical relief.
Yes. After a few days, he switches them to a placebo without telling them. They get robust pain relief, as expected, but this time when he administers naloxone.
The opioid blocker.
Right. It does not block the placebo effect. Their pain relief continues uninterrupted.
Wait, really? If naloxone didn't stop it, that means the brain wasn't using opioids.
It wasn't. Because the brain had learned the specific chemical pathway of the non-opioid drug, it released targeted molecules based on exactly what kind of relief it expected. It didn't just dump generic endorphins into the system.
That implies a level of subconscious intelligence that's just staggering. It tailored the chemical output. And we see this beyond pain, don't we?
We do. And this is where it gets undeniable. Look at Parkinson's disease.
Parkinson's is a neurodegenerative disorder where you lack a specific chemical dopamine.
Right, which causes tremors and rigidity. In 2001, De La Fuente Fernandez ran PET scans on Parkinson's patients. He gave them a placebo, but told them it was their anti-Parkinson's medication.
And what did the scan show?
The PEAT scans showed that the placebo caused a massive release of endogenous dopamine in the striatum.
The brain flooded itself with the exact chemical it was failing to produce.
Yes. And Benedetti actually took this further in 2004 during awake neurosurgery on Parkinson's patients.
Awake brain surgery?
Yeah, he inserted microelectrodes to record single individual neurons. When he gave them a placebo, those individual neurons instantly changed their electrical firing patterns. Exactly as if the patient had taken a heavy pharmacological dose of a real dopaminergic drug.
What's fascinating here is that the neurons in your brain literally do not care about the origin of the chemical.
They don't care at all.
They don't care if the dopamine arrives via a pill in the bloodstream or via a belief from the prefrontal cortex. The molecular machinery is identical. Only the initiating signal differs.
That is the mind-blowing reality of this. Same cascade, two directions.
I want to connect this back to something every single listener has experienced. Think about the last time you had a spleen headache.
We've all been there.
You grab an Advil, you swallow it with water, and 5 minutes later, you feel this wave of relief. You think, ah, the medicine is kicking in.
But biologically?
Biologically, it's impossible. A pill swallowed whole does not reach your bloodstream in 5 minutes. It's still sitting in your stomach acid. The chemical relief is at least 30 minutes away.
So what's actually happening in that 5 minute window?
Your prefrontal cortex has recognized the ritual of taking the medicine. It deploys your own endogenous opioids to cover the gap. You are literally high on your own expectation while you wait for the drug to digest.
It's a perfect example of downward causation in your everyday life.
But if the brain can deploy a pharmacy to heal you based on expectation, it stands to reason it can also deploy a poison.
And that is the dark side of expectation, the nocebo effect.
Here's where it gets really interesting, the nocebo mirror.
Yeah, it is the exact same mechanism running in reverse, initiated by fear or negative expectation.
If the brain uses opioids and dopamine to heal, what is the chemical signature of the nocebo effect? How does it hurt itself?
Instead of opioids, the nocebo effect for pain releases a specific peptide called cholecystokinin, or CCK.
And what does CCK do?
It actively amplifies pain transmission in the nervous system.
Why would evolution give us a chemical that makes pain worse just because we're scared?
Well, from an evolutionary standpoint, if you anticipate a physical threat like a predator, heightening your pain sensitivity makes you hypervigilant. But in a modern clinical setting, it's a massive liability.
And just like we can block placebos within the naloxone, can we block the nocebo effect?
We can. We can physically block it by giving a patient a specific CCK antagonist.
So if a doctor says, hold still, this is going to be a sharp pinch, they're triggering your prefrontal cortex to pump CCK into your system.
Exactly, ensuring the needle hurts more than it needed to. But the clinical consequences go way beyond a needle pinch.
Tell me about the Parkinson's trial dropouts.
Yeah, Leo Ratto in 2019 analyzed clinical trials for Parkinson's, specifically looking at the placebo arms.
The people receiving no active ingredients at all.
Right. 56% of patients in the placebo arm reported adverse events.
Over half. From a sugar pill.
It gets worse. 5.7% had side effects so severe, so physically intolerable, that they dropped out of the trial entirely.
From an inert substance. Because okay. They read an informed consent document.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They read a list of horrible side effects. Their prefrontal cortex absorbed it, generated a terrified representation, and sent the command to physically manufacture those symptoms.
They were poisoned by informed consent.
The ethical implications are massive. Look at the 2007 Mondini study with finasteride.
The hair loss and prostate drug, famous for potential sexual side effects.
Right. Mondini gave a cohort of men the exact same active drug, but one group was explicitly warned by the doctor about erectile dysfunction, and the other group wasn't warned.
Same drug, same dose.
But the men who were explicitly warned experienced sexual side effects at nearly double the rate of the men who weren't.
Double the rate.
The words a doctor says, or the list on a pill bottle, are not just information. Delivered in a clinical context, they physically reconfigure your biological systems.
This totally changes how we should view WebMD anxiety.
Oh, absolutely.
Because reading about rare symptoms at 2 in the morning isn't just making you nervous. You might be actively instructing your biology to generate those symptoms via CCK.
You're essentially writing a nocebo prescription for yourself.
Okay, so to make sense of how an abstract thought like reading a side effect turns into a physical chemical like CCK, we need a philosophical framework. How do we name this relationship?
This is where Dietz introduces the nested closure architecture, the closure framework.
Let's break that down. He defines two distinct levels, right?
Yes. The bottom level is biological closure. This is the body's homeostatic self-regulation. Its grammar consists of physical things, receptor binding, molecules, physiological parameters.
Chemistry doing chemistry.
Right. The level above that is cognitive closure. This is the level of conscious self-representation.
So its grammar is abstract. Temporal relations, social contexts, representations of future states.
Exactly. It's the level that understands what it means to be a patient sitting in a clinic. A white coat means nothing to a dopamine receptor, but it means a great deal to cognitive closure.
And how do they interact?
Through what Dietz calls downward causation. The higher cognitive level causally modifies the lower biological level using the lower level's own machinery.
The healing context provides a grammar that the patient inhabits, which propagates downward.
Exactly.
Okay, but I have to push back here. Wait, does this solve the hard problem of consciousness? Are we saying we finally know exactly how a thought turns into physical matter?
No, absolutely not. And Dietz is very explicit about this boundary. This does not solve the hard problem of consciousness.
So we still don't know the metaphysical how.
We are bracketing the how of irreducible consciousness. We are just tracing the causal address, the prefrontal cortex, and observing that downward causation is an empirical fact.
Like how doctors know morphine works, without perfectly understanding how receptor occupancy translates to the subjective feeling of pain relief.
Exactly. We can use it without perfectly understanding the ultimate metaphysical bridge.
Okay, but if the cognitive level requires an expectation to trigger the biology, does that mean the whole system relies on lying to the patient?
The false belief objection.
Yeah. Must we hold a false belief for the placebo to work? Are doctors doomed to deceive us?
This is where the source material is truly revolutionary. Dietz points to open-label placebos, or OLP.
Meaning the label literally says placebo.
Yes. The foundational trial was Ted Kapchuk in 2010. He studied patients with irritable bowel syndrome, IBS.
A very painful, difficult to treat condition.
He gave patients placebo pills and explicitly told them, these are inert, there is no active medication in them.
But they still took them.
Yes. He explained that the mind-body healing processes can be activated just by taking them in a supportive medical context.
And what happened?
They showed huge improvements, statistically massive improvements in their IBS symptoms, comparable to the best actual drugs on the market.
Wait, really? They knew it was fake.
They knew. And this kills the false belief objection. What activates the biological cascade is not a proposition, a true or false belief about the pill.
It's the grammar of the healing encounter.
Exactly.
So it's sitting across from a clinician who takes your suffering seriously.
Yeah.
It's the ritual of swallowing a pill. It's the scheduled follow-up. You don't have to logically believe the pill is medicine. You just have to inhabit the structure of being cared for.
A grammar cannot be true or false. It can only be inhabited. And inhabiting it releases the dopamine.
And this wasn't just one study, right?
No, it's been replicated widely. Carvalho in 2016 for chronic low back pain, Honemeyer and Zhu for cancer-related fatigue.
Cancer fatigue improved from a known sugar pill.
Yes. And, crucially, Sandler and Bodfish in 2008 used OLP for ADHD in kids.
Why is the kids' study so important?
Because skeptics often say adults are just faking their symptom questionnaires to please the researchers. Demand characteristics.
Right, trying to be polite.
But you can't really argue that children with ADHD are faking sustained behavioral improvements just to appease a study design. It proves it's real biology.
Okay, if we don't need deception, just the continuous inhabitation of a healing grammar. What happens when you inhabit that grammar for an entire lifetime?
This is where we look at timescales, from minutes to decades.
Let's start with the intermediate scale.
Look at Aaliyah Crumb's work in 2011, the milkshake study.
Tell me about the milkshake study.
She gives people identical milkshakes on two different days, but one is labeled a 620-calorie indulgent shake.
Okay.
And the other is labeled a 140-calorie sensible diet shake.
But they were literally the exact same 380-calorie shake.
Identical. But she measured their blood levels of ghrelin, the satiety hormone that regulates metabolism.
Right.
When they thought they drank the indulgent shake, their ghrelin levels dropped three times as much as when they thought they drank the diet shake.
Three times as much. So their digestive metabolism physically altered its hormonal response based on the text printed on the label.
The grammar of the label altered the chemistry of the gut. And Crumb also did a study with hotel workers in 2007.
The maids' cleaning rooms.
Yes. They did intense physical labor, but didn't view it as exercise. Crum just gave them a 15-minute presentation framing their daily work as good exercise.
And did their activity change?
No, they didn't work any harder. But in 4 weeks, they had dropped blood pressure, weight, and BMI just from changing the cognitive grammar of how they viewed their labor.
That is wild. So what about the lifetime scale?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, we have to look at Becca Levy's longitudinal studies of over 11,000 adults. She looked at age beliefs.
Our cultural grammar about getting older.
Right. Positive age beliefs versus negative age beliefs. She found that positive age beliefs were the single strongest predictor against dementia, a 30% reduction.
Just from thinking positively about aging.
Yes. And it added 7.5 years of life expectancy compared to negative age beliefs.
7.5 years.
Levy's research is essentially open-label placebo at the scale of decades. A sustained representation of yourself held in a supportive cultural grammar literally restructures your biological fate.
Okay, but if this top-down biological force can cure IBS, alter gut hormones, and add 7.5 years to our lives, why does modern medicine still treat it as an annoyance?
Dietz argues it's because of the epistemological flaw of the randomized controlled trial, the RCT.
The gold standard of medical testing.
Right. The RCT was designed to isolate drug effects from context. It defines the drug effect as whatever happens above the placebo baseline.
Right. You subtract the placebo group's improvement to find the real drug's power.
But Dietz argues the RCT draws its boundary exactly where cognitive and biological closures interact. Patients in both the drug arm and the placebo arm inhabit the healing grammar.
They both get the clinician's care, the ritual, the expectation.
Yes.
So it's like if you're trying to measure the brightness of a new flashlight bulb.
Yes.
Right. The drug.
Okay, I'm tracking.
You test the flashlight in one room, and you have the fake, unpowered plastic bulb in a control room, the placebo. But the RCT flaw is that both of those rooms have massive, blazing ceiling lights turned on for the whole test.
Yes. The ceiling light is the healing grammar.
Right. The RCT measures the gap between the rooms, subtracts the placebo room, and concludes the only real light is the tiny flashlight bulb. It's totally blind to the massive ceiling light blazing in both rooms because it just calls it baseline noise.
That is exactly it. The RCT isn't comparing medicine versus nothing. It's comparing pharmacological initiation plus cognitive initiation versus cognitive initiation alone. It's measuring an output while entirely blind to half the inputs.
Does Dietz say we should abandon RCTs then?
No, not at all. Dietz isn't saying we abandon them. They are great for finding out if a chemical does anything extra. But the placebo problem exists because the RCT grammar is philosophically incapable of modeling downward causation.
Wow. Okay, so what is the ultimate takeaway here? The paradigm shift is that the therapeutic encounter is not just the delivery mechanism for pharmacological treatment. It is a pharmacological intervention.
The invisible prescription, written in the grammar of healing, uses the exact same biological pathways as the drugs themselves.
So the next time you go to the doctor, or even when you engage in self-talk about your health, don't view it as fluffy bedside manner or positive vibes. View it as literal commands sent to your prefrontal cortex to release specific neurotransmitters.
And that leads to a final lingering thought from the text's ethical implications.
What's that?
If cultural grammars, like how we view aging, dictate our biological health, then this isn't just an individual responsibility. We shouldn't just blame patients for not thinking positively.
Right, that's toxic.
Exactly. Instead, we must realize that societies that construct degrading, ageist cultural grammars are making a collective institutional decision that actively harms population biology.
What other societal narratives are we currently inhabiting that are secretly dictating our public health? It really leaves you to mull on how the stories your culture tells you are literally writing your biology.